The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com. Hello, welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
You start to see more progression into people directly and their relationship, so more of a human focus. And then also, I guess, in the more recent years, you will see that play with concept and fiction and reality.
How does a city change with nighttime? This week we report from a new exhibition at the Museum of London highlighting how the city changes once the sun sets. Then, will the future be driverless? A discussion about mobility in the years ahead. And finally, is the project for light rail finally becoming reality in Canberra? We'll be finding out. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Tom Edwards. So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. Nighttime changes the urban silhouette, from the people that roam the streets after dark to the events and life unfolding during the long hours of night. A new exhibition at the Museum of London called London Nights wants to highlight this often forgotten side of the city. It features more than 200 images from almost 60 different photographers that have captured the nighttime capital over a century. Monocle's Sophia Amadi went to speak to the exhibition's curator, Anna Sparham, and brings us this report.
There was a time when capturing the city at night through a lens was near impossible. But by the mid-1900s, as developments in illumination, especially through the increased use of street lighting, coincided with the shortening of camera exposure times, photographers began to explore the darker and often more ambiguous subject matter of life after hours. Illuminating the hidden nocturnal life and landscape of cities became a welcome challenge for photographers who sought to tackle the inherent complexities the medium posed. And it was not until the late 1900s that night photography became truly universal with the advent of the digital camera. At the Museum of London's new exhibition, London Nights, we witness a mix of old and contemporary photography that charts the evolution of London's nocturnal imagery, from voyeuristic peaks into suburbia to abstract takes of office blocks and construction sites, to the bustling hubs of landmarks like Trafalgar Square and Piccadilly, and stark reminders of a city once engulfed in war. The collection documents the different moods the capital projects at night, and the ever-changing silhouette of its urban landscape captured over time. I spoke with Anna Sparham, the museum's curator of photographs.
I think in the earlier days, it's all about capturing that vision of London, which we now take so for granted, whether that's floodlighting landmarks or sort of low light levels, dark alleyways, that sort of thing. So there's very much that focus on the aesthetic of the landscape. And then as the decades progress from the turn of the century, you start to see more progression into people directly and their relationship. So more of a human focus. And then also, I guess, in the more recent years, you will see that play with concept and fiction and reality. I mean, that stretches back to the sort of 30s and Bill Brandt's work, you know, perceived to be documentary, but certainly a lot of staged imagery there.
During World War II, British photographer Bill Brandt took advantage of the blackout conditions to photograph the streets of London by moonlight. Later commissioned by the Ministry of Information, Brandt set out to document shelter life to communicate positive messages of Blitz spirit as he captured the resilience of Londoners hiding underground as bombs fell overhead. Here's Anna again.
Gradually, you get those different experiences that people can encounter and that eclecticness of what the city has to offer. And one thing, I guess, also is that in our exhibition, you'll see the earlier material tends to be more centrally located. So the sort of tourism images you'd expect to see of Piccadilly and bright lights of the centre, and then through to more contemporary work, which goes right out to the edges of London and across the breadth of the city.
As daylight fades, our cities transform under the artificial light that enables these metropolises to stay awake after dark. Throughout the 250 photographs on show, the exhibition paints an overall experience of the city that is recognisable to its inhabitants, as well as at times surreal and often incomprehensible.
So one piece Thierry Cohen made of his series Darkened Cities, he's looking at the city landscape, the nightscape, and you look at this magnificent depiction of London, the skyline of London, lit by thousands and thousands of stars, and it's that one thing we all know living in London that you don't get to see. So immediately you start to question what this image is and how it's shot. Basically, the skyline is shot in the daytime, so the landscape is not illuminated. And then Thierry Cohen travelled the same latitude across the globe to the deserts of Kazakhstan and photographed the amazing starlit sky there and digitally composited the image together. It's one example where you have this sort of duality of artifice and reality and being able to question elements of London such as light pollution and atmospheric pollution and see how the experience we have in the city is wonderful and at the same time there's something that may be missing. And I think that reflects the different nature of the photography we have in the exhibition.
Just like the image Cohen shot of the night sky, this duality of artifice and reality can be found elsewhere in the museum. Eerie dreamlike landscapes of suburbia, devoid of people, uncover the intensely quiet inactivity of certain areas of London at night and are portrayed as simultaneously beautiful and yet often inelegant. This dichotomy continues into pictures of office blocks and construction works, a view only too familiar with inhabitants of any urban landscape today.
The landscape, the urban landscape of London, you can see those changes over time, certainly in the earlier pictures we have in the archive of floodlit landmarks from Trafalgar Square or even just individual buildings that are beautifully floodlit post-war, so out of the blackout, and you get the sense of history that obviously comes across through the architecture of London and that richness that comes through. But then there's also works such as Lewis Bush's series called Metropole that deals with the changing landscape and the transition that the landscape goes through. And some people embrace that and some people react against it. Lewis's series and the way it's constructed through kind of multi-layered exposures shows how, especially at night, that sense of disorientating intensity of constant building sites or loads and loads of high-rises taking over the centre. He's making the point that it sort of loses its rich history and loses its identity.
In other parts of the exhibition, identity is portrayed as paramount to the photographic experience, as other photographers capture the routines that are etched onto the daily canvas of the city at night.
Another piece, a set of colour work by Nick Turpin, looks at the journey on the night bus or the evening bus home from work. It's just such a recognisable experience that we all share in. If we're working in London, leaving behind your work life and the personality you may have there, transitioning to home, and that home experience and that domestic scene is, again, just as important in talking about London at night and our experiences of that. So Nick Turpin's images are shot through the top deck of a bus window on a series of evenings in the winter. You get these amazing painterly images where you've got the condensation on the windows that have been rubbed away by passengers, the rain outside, etc., and the sort of different saturated colours that come through in those images, capturing the light in the interior of the bus. But really you're looking into this little world of individual people in their own little moments, whether they're on the phone or reading or something. It represents those moments where in the exhibition you'll recognise aspects of London as well as looking at the unfamiliar scenes.
For Monocle in London, I'm Sophia Armadi.
Thanks, Sophia. That was Monocle's Sophia Armadi, and the exhibition London Nights is on display at the Museum of London until November. A lot of talk in the area where tech and urbanism meet focuses on driverless cars. We're told that they're just around the corner. But how close are they really, and what impact could they have on the makeup of our cities? A report recently released by leading global real estate advisory firm Cushman & Wakefield has analysed exactly that, as well as trends across the sector. Kat Hanna is an urbanist and researcher at Cushman & Wakefield. She had a hand in the report and told Emma Nelson all about the findings.
A lot of vehicles have some sort of autonomous capacity as it is, and you know the way it's often defined is you have zero to five levels of automation. So zero is your car that has absolutely no capacity for automation whatsoever. Five being fully driverless, any environment, you can literally, you know, there's not even a steering wheel. It's 100% hands off. And then, like you said, there's a big range in the middle. And increasingly, again, it's all about building up that capacity, or at least building it in so in the future you could be getting towards full autonomy. Part of the challenge, actually, is, though, is working in kind of unpredictable environments. So the one that often comes up a lot is, you know, snow, actually. So generally, you can have something that is completely driverless, but actually in 100% of environments, no matter what happens, that's still a bit of a challenge. So again, that's where things like operating in a specific environment come in quite handy as well, because you're minimising the risk of those unpredictable environments that are going to throw up some challenges for a vehicle.
You've also got the planning, not just of the buildings, not just of the cars themselves, but actually the urban infrastructure, indeed the rural infrastructure that's going to have to accommodate these things. Where are we now in terms of regulation, rules, laws? Who designs the traffic lights? Who owns the traffic lights? Who controls the traffic lights? That kind of stuff. It's a whole way of thinking transport from zero.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, and again, there is some frustration with people saying, let's not use this as a means of just redesigning cities around just another type of vehicle. You know, I think a lot of people would say, actually, we kind of made that mistake first time round with cars. Let's really not make sure we do it again. But I think actually one of the exciting things about AVs is it allows us to start a question about what kind of city do we want and how do people expect to move around in it and how can we make that experience better for them? So again, you know, one of the things we highlight in the report is saying, you know, the AV piece is just one part of that puzzle of the future of mobility. And, you know, and I think, for example, particularly in, you know, dense urban locations like London, public transport is always going to be key, because just the sheer volume of people that you need to move, often in quite a short amount of time, you know, you think of rush hour, no matter, even if you're having shared autonomous vehicles, putting that amount of people onto the street is just not going to be feasible. But then you said you get to your rural locations and you're looking at really quite a different model as well. Or then again, even your sort of suburban retail park. So again, it's really understanding actually how are people already using this space? What are their needs in terms of whether it's commuting, whether it's for leisure, whether it's, you know, for example, looking at people for whom mobility is often a challenge. So it might be visually impaired people, it might be the elderly. So again, really understanding that, often using data to do that. And then saying, well, how can we then use technology to improve that? And again, I think necessarily leaping to driverless cars as the answer is not the right one.
Oh, no. I mean, when you listed all those things that need to be thought through, the first thing that came to my mind is that, you know, is any landlord of any big building going to say, yes, I'm going to allocate a certain amount of space for these driverless cars and, you know, I'll dip into my own pocket and pay for all the facilities that are needed? And councils, local authorities all over the world are consistently pleading poverty. They've got to pay for the streets to be cleaned and lit, let alone adapted for a driverless car.
Yeah, and, you know, boroughs like the one we're sitting in now actually get a huge amount of their money from parking and actually people paying parking. So it's another challenge there. So, and I think you're right, again, it's who are all these stakeholders actually that either stand to lose or to gain, or who actually need to be thinking about this? One question I'm often quite asked is, well, if I'm building a development now, how many car parking spaces should I have? Is it maybe I don't need, you know, one potential thing for autonomous vehicles is you can decouple the parking from the location you want to be. So rather than if I'm going to a shopping centre that's, say, in the centre of town, I don't need to pay lots of money. And if I'm a landlord, I don't need to use that space that I could be using for retail or for restaurants or a hotel. I don't need to spend it on cars. I can actually use it for a different type of amenity. So that's, again, quite an exciting opportunity. But like you said, it's kind of a big bet to be like, all right, we'll just have no parking and we'll hope people will still come and we'll kind of worry about what happens in 5-10 years. So I think we'll see a couple of things happening. I think one is, I think there will be some developers and landlords that are actually going to say, do you know what, we are going to lead the way in this. We are going to be AV ready. So that might be saying, OK, we're actually just going to have drop-off points outside the front of our building. It's amazing even now, the lack of places, again, like shopping centres. You try and get an Uber, the Uber has no idea where to go. It goes into the car park because it's in the station. It's driving round and round and it's suddenly in some weird side road or the loading bay to John Lewis. And, you know, it's, you know, thinking about some of those challenges. And then it's also saying, well, again, what type of development do I want? So, and how can I then actually lead people in the direction of where I want to be? So there's some nice examples, even, for example, I think it's actually in Manchester, a residential developer who said, we actually would rather encourage people not to take up their parking space, so we're going to offer them credit to use Uber instead. Because actually the fewer people that use that parking space in that, we could maybe build a gym instead to have in the residential development, or we could actually just build more housing. So again, in it saying, well, it's not just not providing parking again, it's saying, how is it people want to move around and how can we make that easier for them without that default of parking spaces?
So how long is it before someone actually genuinely, some great urban planner bites the bullet and says, right, OK, you know, you said we've got this pilot scheme going on in America. Who, go and put your money on the table, which country, which city is going to say, OK, we're going to embrace this?
In terms of driverless vehicles, yep. Totally. I think some of the Scandinavian cities, again, particularly I think somewhere like Oslo, because if you actually look, so, you know, for example, Tesla ownership, Norway is incredibly high. So again, actually, it's them saying we're talking about cars that already have some of that capacity inbuilt. Tesla is one of those kind of companies. Again, you've also got a different type of model. Somewhere like Oslo, you've actually got more private ownership of vehicles. So again, it's there are challenges around that. And again, it's saying, as a city, what are the options that we want to provide people? The issue is, if you provide a lot of parking spaces, a lot of people will come in and park. So again, I think that's another issue of people saying, well, actually, what could we start doing with some of that space that's in those locations? There's also some really nice examples in the US where, again, you ask this challenge about, if I'm building now, how do I prepare a building that's going to still work in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time? Is actually building car parks at the bottom of a residential development, but actually designing them in a way that later on they can ideally be converted. Again, so it might be putting a theatre in, it might be putting some office space in that bottom space as well. So there are some architects that are really thinking about this quite boldly. And again, saying, you know, if we are investing a huge amount of money in a new development, the last thing we want is obsolescence in 5, 10 years' time, because it's just going to be a criminal waste. And again,
so to the urban equivalent of a mini disc.
Something like that, exactly. Exactly.
That was the urbanist Kat Hannah from Cushman & Wakefield talking to Monocle's Emma Nelson. And a reminder, mobility and the future of driverless cars is one of the core themes in our forthcoming Monocle Quality of Life Conference, which takes place in Zurich from the 28th to the 30th of June. To find out more and to buy your tickets, head to conference.monocle.com. This is The Urbanist. You're with The Urbanist on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. London, Paris, Mexico City, these are all capitals known for their world-famous metro train systems, not so Australia's capital, Canberra. With a population of fewer than 400,000 spread across an area the size of Greater London, it's long been the domain of the car. Light rail was in the original plans for the city, as drawn up by its architect and designer Walter Burley Griffin early in the 20th century. Now, more than 100 years later, Capital Metro will soon be transporting Canberra citizens around the city. Local radio presenter Adam Shirley told James Viver why it took so long.
Burley Griffin, who originally designed and won the design competition for Canberra, always envisaged a network of various transport options through the inner and growing parts of Canberra. And there was an element of train or tram travel that he had a vision for, let's say, along with Marion Marnie Griffin, who was a key part of the whole development of the design of Canberra too. Whilst there was an amenity built into the plan of Walter Burley Griffin and Marion Marnie Griffin's vision, it never became a reality until far more recent history, for a number of reasons: cost, logistics, who would be responsible for planning and building it, and the amount of time it might take to effectively retrofit a public transport system based on rails into a capital like Canberra.
Canberra's very much a car city, isn't it? And so I'm wondering how Canberrans thought about the idea of light rail as the decades went on and the city got bigger.
In the early days, people, when they heard the term and the initial plan, thought, as if that will ever be built. I think that's a fair generalisation of what the majority of Canberrans assumed about light rail. Nice in concept, people thought, I'll believe it when I see it. What happened was, increasing gridlock at certain times of the day, which Canberra hasn't really experienced and still does not experience to a degree that big cities do, started to sharpen people's minds. And the Labor government of the day, in a majority form and then a minority form, kept up the fight, as it were. They continued with, it must be said, a push from the Greens partners they have in government to keep carrying the flag for light rail. And I suppose enough people heard about it enough times while stuck in their cars at 8:30 in the morning and 5 p.m. at night to think, well, is this a better option and do we need to give it a second look?
So 2016 then, the election comes around and the opposition made it basically a referendum on light rail. got pretty testy, didn't it? Tell us about that election and how it's ended up.
The story actually starts also at the previous election, when the Labor government raised the idea of planning stage one of light rail and that they would like to build it. At that election back in 2012, they were voted back into government with the support of Greens. They couldn't have formed government without them. So at that stage, the government argued Canberrans have said yes to light rail. This is 2012 into 2016, the next election you're referring to. But yes, in the years and months leading up to that election, the ACT opposition fairly and squarely targeted it. We're talking about a project that was budgeted at $1 billion and that had one track from a northern area of Canberra down to the central area that would be the route built initially to the tune of $1 billion. So a lot of Canberrans not on that route. The opposition thought they would be on a bit of a winner politically because of the divisive nature of the debate and the first stage being quite limited in how much of Canberra's broader populace it would cover. The result of the 2016 election was quite instructive. Many pundits were predicting an opposition victory. A lot of people thought the opposition were onto something in terms of the number of people that didn't like light rail and would vote against Labor when they previously might have voted for that party. That did not eventuate. The vote stayed more or less static. And after, 15 plus years of Labor government, people were surprised by that when you had a divisive issue that was put at the centre of the election campaign. In the end, it didn't seem to be nearly as decisive as what a lot of people were saying.
One of the arguments from the government in making the case for light rail was how much development there would be along the rail corridor. And you've only got to travel down Northbourne Avenue where the train, most of it runs. And you're seeing it now, aren't you? It is actually genuinely transforming the centre of Canberra.
Along a couple of arterials at this stage, absolutely. I mentioned before the existing buildings, their land values have gone and will go up. New hotels are being built along that route. There are other services, hospitality areas that are being built to try and maximise or take advantage of the stops where people will get on and get off. There is an element of if you build it, they will come faith to it though. It obviously remains to be seen just how much it will enliven what has been a main traffic arterial into more of a mixed use area. The government has pinned some hope on exactly that happening. But given Canberra is such a car reliant city, time will tell whether people use their feet more along an area where car has been the ruler.
What comes next then? Because this is stage one, isn't it? So where's it going to go next?
So as we mentioned, there is only one, and a significant population, but one population in Gungahlin that's being serviced at the northernmost point, running all the way down the central northern vein of Canberra, if you will, to the city centre. Stage two has recently been announced by the government and some $30 million plus for planning it as well. That route starts at Civic, the endpoint of stage one, if you will, in the city, over Lake Burley Griffin, which is the centrepiece of water that divides Canberra's north and south, through that to part the Parliament House region, though not Parliament House itself, many public service offices in those suburbs around Parliament House, and then further down to a central southern town centre, which is called Woden. That area has a lot of private and public workers in it. It is an area that has grown somewhat tired to look at and in its feel as well. So it's hoped that that endpoint of light rail in the south side will again re-energise and reform an area where a lot of Canberrans live, but do claim who live there services are waning and they would like an update in a variety of ways.
You going to use it?
I certainly will. If anything out of interest, I don't live and won't live close to either stage one or stage two and the route. I only live about 10 minutes bike ride from it though, and absolutely I want to get on and see whether the times the government has guaranteed for a north, south and a south, north trip are going to be what they're claiming, whether there are a lot of people through the day that are using it. Canberra has a very set but quite contracted rush hour in the morning and evening, and one of the benefits I think we'd all like to see from light rail is that it gets used throughout the day for a variety of stops, things like cafes, accommodation, even hospital and health services. That is why in the Gold Coast setting I referred to earlier, it's working, because there are universities, hospitals, tourism all along the route, so multiple reasons for tourists and locals alike to use it. I would like to ride it to see if the Canberra experience is as positive in that regard.
Thank you.
Adam Shirley, presenter on ABC Radio Canberra there, in conversation with Monocle contributor James Viver. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Christy Evans, David Stevens and Sarah Miles. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Chromeo with Frequent Flyer. Thanks for listening, city lovers.
Have you ever met a frequent flyer, dressed in all white attire, sipping on a Grace papaya, wanna take you higher? Jet lag, you must be tired, watch out, you might misfire.